Good morning. So it was 2003, and I was still living up in the Seattle area. I was working as a youth intern at a church, and I was living with a couple, a young couple, and the husband needed a ride up to Vancouver, Canada. It was like a 3.5 hour drive up there, and he asked me if I could drive him up, drop him off, and then drive home by myself, and I could use his truck. No problem. So early one morning, together, we drive up to Canada, and it's a fairly easy drive from Seattle. We printed out a MapQuest direction, remember MapQuest, and we found the place without any real issues. I leave him there, and I head home. As I'm pulling up to the US border, I see signs that say, "Please have your passport or US driver's license ready." And I go for my wallet, but it's not there. It's not in my pockets, it's not in the center console, it's not under the seats or along the sides of my seats. And I'm starting to get fairly panicked because I'm driving a car, someone else's car, across an international border 2 years after 9/11, and I have zero identification on me at all. None. I have nothing to show who I am. Nothing to verify that I'm an American. Nothing to verify that I have any permission to be driving this car or any car. And now, as I roll up to the border agent, I'm sweating, and this guy immediately can tell that something is up. "Citizenship?" he asks. I reply, "The United States." "Proof?" he asks. "Well, I can't find my wallet. I think I left it at home this morning down near Seattle." "Please pull over, sir. Right over to the side. Go inside and wait in line and talk to an official." I was terrified. And the next part of the process was hours long. The wait in line was long, but then my conversation with the official was even longer. She just grilled me. "What city were you born in? Where else have you lived? What elementary schools did you go to? What were your teachers' names? What do you like to do for fun? Did you have a pet? What happened to it? What was your favorite TV show growing up?" So many questions, and many of them, I'm not sure they had anything to do with my citizenship, but it was like this for over an hour. And then finally, out of nowhere, she said, "Okay, drive your car across the border. And since you don't have a driver's license on you, you'll need to park and wait for someone to come and bring it to you." I couldn't believe it. I mean, I didn't have any idea what to expect, but because this was so soon after 9/11, I just thought this could have been really bad. These days, I love telling this story, usually just because it comes up as people are sharing funny stories. And sometimes it's a bit of, historical evidence about how absent-minded I can be. But it came to mind this week as I was working through this morning's passage, because it is all about how we verify our identity. Who are you? And what am I going to ask of you to prove it? Right? If you tell me your name, I'm probably just going to take you at your word. You know that this is the name I'm then going to call you, so I'm assuming you'll give me the name that you want me to use. I have no reason to question. If you come to my door claiming to be a police officer, the uniform and the badge will probably be enough proof. But if you are a detective in plain clothes, I might ask for ID or a couple more questions. The other day, I used my debit card to pay someone else's bill over the phone. I called, gave them the account number, and then told them I wanted to pay the bill. And they took all of my card info and never once asked for a name. They just wanted the money. They didn't care who it came from. No verification necessary. For the last 2 weeks, we've been exploring Paul's letter to the churches in Galatia. At the heart of this letter that Paul wrote is identity and verification. Who are you and how do we know it? Paul's central concern is this: are you part of God's family? And his follow-up question is, how can we be sure? And I want you to really have a sense of how pressing these questions were for the early church. See, throughout Galatia, there were synagogues of Jews all over the region, and the Jews knew themselves to be the people of Yahweh, the one true God. They were his children. They were his special treasured possession. And now, outsiders, Gentiles, these non-Jews would occasionally want to follow the God of Israel, and they were welcome to. The Jewish people had an openness to outsiders wanting to learn about their God. And there are now two kinds of Gentiles who would follow the God of Israel. Most were called God-fearers. And they would come around and they would show up at the synagogue and they would learn the scriptures and they would adopt many of Yahweh's ethical practices. But they would never go all the way, never fully commit. And then there was this second kind of follower, the select few Gentiles who would fully convert to the Jewish faith, right? They would join the family of God by getting circumcised. They would become part of the covenant chosen people. Now, in that world, the lines were very clear. You knew exactly who was in, who was out, and who was just kind of dabbling on the edges. But Paul tells the story in chapter 4 of when he came to Galatia announcing the good news. Right? That Jesus had come and died in order to welcome all people into God's family. And his message was clear. Jesus alone is the true King of the earth. Follow him and live. Trust him and be made new. And what happened in Galatia? Gentiles everywhere began to entrust their lives to Jesus. They began to receive the Spirit of God and they began to live as part of God's family. Simple as that. Except the obvious question arises, how are all of the local Jews to believe that these conversions were real without some sort of evidence? Right? How could they trust that these Gentiles were really part of the family, their family, the family of God, and how could they trust them? In this light, circumcision, like, feels like a really good rite of initiation. It's public. It's visible. It's a little painful. So it communicates that somebody really wants in if they're willing to undergo it. So circumcision was seen by some as the way to verify that your faith in God was real. But the Jews had another obvious motivation as well. They were really worried about their public reputation. See, in the first century, there were all sorts of laws throughout the empire requiring everyone to worship Rome's many gods, their pantheon. Rules were different in different places, but there were serious consequences if you refused to worship Rome's gods. Well, the Jewish people scattered throughout the empire were one of the few groups of people who had been given special permission by Rome to worship their own God alone, to worship Yahweh alone, and they had permission to not participate in any of the idol worship throughout the empire. I mean, talk about huge. But it was also politically fragile. Jewish communities were often worried that they could lose their freedom to worship at any given moment. And so you can see how this stress could create this intense pressure on the Jewish synagogues. They couldn't just have people running around claiming to be Jewish who might then get them in trouble and have their freedoms taken away from them. But this is exactly what's happening. You have all of these brand new followers of Yahweh, of Yahweh's son, but none of them look Jewish. They don't eat in Jewish ways. They don't observe Jewish holidays. But as you can see from Paul's letter, when He describes the works of the flesh in chapter 5, verse 19. He lists idolatry as one of the practices that keeps us from inheriting the kingdom of God. These early Gentile followers of Jesus were imitating the Jews in this one thing. They began to worship Yahweh, and at the same time, they rejected all of Rome's gods, refusing to continue worshiping them. And so you can imagine they began to get questioned by the authorities. And when they were questioned, these new followers of Jesus, they claimed to be part of the Jews. They claimed to be part of the Jewish faith. They claimed that they were now children of Abraham, worshiping the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who had now come and revealed himself in the Messiah, Jesus. I mean, can you feel the tension that exists, right? These new followers of Jesus, they don't look or act anything like Jews, at least on the surface, but they are claiming to be part of the Jewish family. The Jews are essentially saying, if you want us to claim you, then give us something to work with. And the Gentile Jesus followers are tempted, right? They're tempted to get circumcised and become culturally Jewish because, well, honestly, that would just solve a lot of the social and political problems for them. It would just help life go easier. It would verify in this very clear and public way to the Jews and to the Roman authorities that these new Gentile converts were truly part of this Jewish faith and they weren't just rogue and claiming to be Jewish. If you've ever seen a person or group publicly claimed to be Christian and you like winced a little or you like wanted to throw up in your mouth a little because you just didn't want to be associated with that kind of group. You might think Westboro Baptist, and you don't want anyone to think that you're that kind of Christian, then you know exactly how the Jews throughout the empire felt about these Gentiles claiming to be part of them. So, with all of that, I want to transition into like some of the specific parts of our passage because I want us to see how Paul addresses this issue. What is Paul's answer to this need for some sort of verification? Because here in chapters 5 and 6, we get into the sort of practical application, if you will. How does the church live this out? And so first, let me just quickly remind us where we've been. Chapters 1 and 2 told us a bit of Paul's personal history with the gospel. Specifically, Paul grounds the gospel in Jesus. Jesus is at the center. We are made right with God. We are made right with each other through Jesus and his faithfulness alone. We all enter into this new life by trusting who Jesus is and what he's done. Everyone, whether you're Jew or Gentile, male or female, slave or free, you get into the family the same way through faith in the Messiah alone. Paul then uses chapters 3 and 4 to take us through this like series of different arguments, all building to Paul's central claim that God has only one family. God has only ever had one family. God doesn't have two families or multiple families. And this family, this one family, was God's plan from the very beginning. A single family made up of people from every nation, every social class, every generation, both male and female. Which brings us then to chapters 5 and 6. And you might be surprised by this, but chapter 5 is actually the first time we find Paul naming circumcision as the specific act that the rival teachers are pushing. And you might be surprised by this because we've been talking about circumcision the whole time because if you've been doing the Bible study, we had you read through the letter all at once early on so you would know, you would recognize that everything he's talking about revolves around this issue. Up until now, like we knew, you know, as you're reading through the letter that some marker of identity is being pushed, but he isn't explicit about what it is. And although he's dropping hints along the way, like early on, Paul makes a big deal about Titus not being forced to be circumcised when they were in Jerusalem. And you can see how he's just laying the seeds. But finally, Paul names it. And in fact, he uses circumcision here in this final chapter, final two chapters, to frame everything that happens here. So that if you read the opening of chapter 5 and the closing of chapter 6, you'll notice that chapter 5 sets up a series of themes or questions that are then brought to a close or answered by the end of chapter 6. For instance, in 5:3, Paul testifies, Galatians 5:3, every man who accepts circumcision is obligated to keep the whole law. Well, then in 6:13, Paul calls out the advocates for circumcision when he says, for even those who are circumcised do not themselves keep the law. In 5:11, Paul points out that he is still being persecuted because of his insistence that circumcision is not required. In 6:12, Paul points out that the advocates for circumcision are trying to avoid persecution. In 5:9, Paul uses a classic image, Jewish image, a little leaven leavens the whole lump. This image is a way of talking about how a little bit of sin can spread throughout a community. Leaven is also associated with pride because it puffs bread up, just as pride is said to puff us up. Well, in 6:12, Paul describes those who want to make a good showing, right? In other words, there are those who want to show off the number of circumcisions they're getting, the number of new Gentiles that they are getting circumcised. They want to make a good showing of it. And he contrasts those with his own boasting in 6:14, when he says, far be it from me to boast, to be puffed up, except in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ. So there's a puffing up over circumcision and the number of people getting circumcised, and there is a puffing up in who Jesus is and what he has done. If you spend some time with the way that Paul's imagery is working, you can see that he is setting us in front of us two options, circumcision and the cross of Christ. Both have the power to leaven the whole lump. Which will you choose? But we already know which way Paul has gone. And again, he uses these two passages at either end of the chapters to set up this provocative set of contrasts. In 5:12, Paul writes, I wish those who unsettle you would emasculate themselves. Literally, in the Greek, cut themselves off or castrate themselves. Scholars debate whether this is Paul being truly angry or just some playful sarcasm. But you can hear what he's saying. I wish those who are trying to force you to cut off part of your skin would just go ahead and cut off their genitals entirely. There might be the subtext here that he wishes they would not be able to reproduce anymore. At the same time, Paul urges the Galatian church to remember his body. In 6:17, Paul reminds them, for I bear on my body the marks of Jesus. Paul sets up this profound irony. The people advocating for circumcision believe this mark on the body will show that a person is really committed. They think circumcision will verify that they are truly believers in their God. In fact, the more and the harder Paul prevents people from getting their bodies marked, the more marks he gets on his body. Listen to what Paul's saying. Look at me. Look at the way that my body has been beaten and struck and scarred and mutilated in all of the same ways as Jesus, all for our God. And you can even hear him saying, for you, I am taking the marks that others are trying to give to you. But he's doing it because that's exactly what Jesus does, taking the wounds that we deserve and our place. But the opponents, they look at Paul and they mock him, and they don't see his marks as the marks of Jesus. They don't see these marks as a sign of his faith or commitment. And so there's this like subtle hint here that for those who become obsessed over the wrong sorts of things, those who emphasize the wrong kinds of signs of verification, they probably aren't going to recognize the real thing even when they see it with their own eyes, even when they see the marks of Jesus in a body in front of them. They're not going to recognize them as the marks of their God. Which brings us then to the last detail between the opening opening of chapter 5 and the closing of chapter 6 that like really brings home what Paul is doing here. Both passages make the same declaration. Neither circumcision counts for anything, nor uncircumcision. Now, it's really important. This is a critical statement that's going to set up Paul's core claim. Because sometimes when we say something definitively, like circumcision doesn't count for anything, people will assume that we're implying something else. Like, for instance, whenever I criticize a political figure or political party, it's immediately assumed by some that I must belong to or support the other party, unless I explicitly say something rejecting both. Well, when Paul criticizes circumcision over and over, and he says circumcision means nothing, it would be easy to assume that it's then better to be uncircumcised. But he's never said that. But here he feels like he needs to clarify. Because if he meant that being uncircumcised was better, then any Jewish follower of Jesus who had been circumcised as a baby and have lived their whole lives as circumcised would now automatically be in a lesser status in the church. But Paul is not claiming that at all. He is not claiming that it is better to be uncircumcised. This call is actually similar to the one he makes in 1 Corinthians when he just basically says, stay as you are. You don't have to do something extra in order to be marked by God, in order to be part of the family. And so Paul makes this explicit. Your circumcision status says absolutely nothing about your faith in Jesus. Followers of Jesus will be both circumcised and uncircumcised. And circumcised or not, it tells us nothing. It verifies nothing about the character or the quality or the genuineness of your faith. While we in the 21st century American church, like, might not be dealing with circumcision as this central verifying fact for whether someone is a Christian or not, we have so many of our own signs and evidences that we treat as a clear sign that somebody is in or out. And really the most obvious one culturally is church attendance. And the most common question people ask to get a sense of whether someone that they work with or you know their kids play soccer with or whatever might also be a Christian is to ask them if they go to church. But in the same way as Paul, we could easily say attending church or not attending church doesn't count for anything. Because you can attend church and not be a Christian. And you can be a Christian who is a vital part of a church that doesn't have the kind of weekly event that most of us call church when we say, do you go to church? In the same way, we are often tempted to assess churches based on how many people attend their weekly gathering. The more people, the better. Fewer is obviously worse. But the number of people who attend any given church can literally tell us nothing about the character of that church, its spiritual health, or its commitment to Jesus. And so let me just encourage you this morning, as a way of processing this passage, in response to this morning's passage, just try to make a list. What are other signs that we look for to verify for us that a Christian is a real Christian, or that a church is a real church? Let me start to wrap up our time with this. Paul says, there are two things that truly matter. Another way to say this would be, there are two things that verify a person trusts Jesus and is part of God's family. In 5:6, Paul says, it is only faith working through love that matters. And in 6:15, Paul says it is a new creation that matters. Faith working through love is the defining characteristic of what makes up the new creation. Faith working through love is what those who are new creations are busy doing. The rest of chapters 5 and 6, the whole section between the opening and closing sections on circumcision, show us what this new creation faith working through love looks like. In 5:13, Paul describes this new creation faith positively, right? By calling the church to serve one another through love. And he also describes it in 5:25 as a living by the Spirit, keeping in step with the Spirit. And he brackets the passage in this way. But Paul also contrasts this new creation faith by saying what it isn't. In 5:15, Paul warns the church not to bite and devour one another. And also in 5:26, Paul urges the church to quote, not become conceited, provoking one another, envying one another. Again, this passage is bracketed, described positively. Paul's descriptions all like capture this big, huge, expansive sense of a widely diverse family working for each other and with each other. Paul describes a mutual care among family members. When he describes the fruit of the Spirit in our lives, Paul describes interpersonal characteristics that capture how we should be with each other. Each characteristic, a gift from God that God's Spirit produces, but that we help cultivate in our lives together. Paul goes on and he describes this gentleness that we have with each other when we correct each other in our sin. And he emphasizes the need for humility in our interactions with each other. And he describes this strange dynamic where we both bear one another's burdens, but also take responsibility for ourselves. In 6 through 10, Paul then talks about the importance of how we use our money and resources within this family. We will value our teachers and will support them financially. And we will invest our resources in God's good work, the work of God's Spirit. This will begin within the family of God, but our generosity won't be contained. It can't be contained. God's goodness will overflow into our non-Christian neighbors. This is Paul's positive description of a church. Want to know what people, do you want to know if people know Jesus, if they trust him, and if they are filled with the Spirit? Look for this kind of life. This is faith working through love. This is what the new creation looks like. And followers of Jesus, nurturing the oneness and unity of God's family. In the same way, Paul describes the kind of people who aren't Jesus people. And it should be immediately obvious. Anyone who tries to divide the church over inessential, unessential practices, beliefs, or visible demonstrations, these are not people walking in the Spirit of Yahweh. Anyone who lives to serve themselves, their own needs, their own in-groups, their own desires, with no consideration for others. These are not people walking in the Spirit of Yahweh. Paul gives us an extensive list of the kinds of behaviors that are characterized by selfishness. And if you look at this list, you'll notice that all of these behaviors, they break relationships, they break trust, they divide communities, they ultimately tear apart God's people. Things like enmity and strife and jealousy and fits of anger, rivalries, dissensions, divisions, and envy, right? They just so obviously divide and tear people apart. It might not be obvious how everything in Paul's list works. So let me just quickly highlight a couple of the less obvious practices. Paul starts with sexual immorality, impurity, and sensuality. See, these three practices, they remind us of the very first break in human relationships. the break between man and woman. God created the man and the woman for a profound kind of intimacy, a kind that was capable of producing actual life in the world. This relationship was supposed to be one of trust, of profound trust and mutuality and partnership. Sex and desire within this context were going to be a dynamic force for good in the world. But the history of humanity tells a story of humans being reduced to objects of desire. Things to be taken and used to satisfy for a second of fleeting urges. There can be no trust in a family where everyone serves their most base and carnal desires, where there is no self-control. A community can't trust that its members are going to do good for each other, even when it's hard. And this is why these categories around sexual practice are considered these works of the flesh. Because outside of God's design and some self-control, these practices divide men and women in such a way that permeates the rest of the community. But a community built on the faithfulness of Jesus needs faithfulness at its center. And ultimate freedom, freedom to fulfill every sexual desire and urge, it just can't have a place in a community that doesn't value faithfulness. Or that, I should say, sorry, that values faithfulness. This is why God put sex within the context of a faithful covenant commitment. If Paul is trying to cultivate the kind of character that can hold the church together, it shouldn't surprise us that he emphasizes the kind of character that can hold a marriage together. That if the church is going to hold together, each individual family is going to be practicing the kinds of things that are necessary for the whole. When Jesus says of marriage, what God has brought together, let no one tear apart. Well, this is also true of the church. In fact, the entire letter of Galatians has been making this case. What God has brought together, let no one tear apart. If someone is trying to tear it apart, cast them out. And so, brings us all the way back to the beginning. What kind of verification is appropriate for the church to identify who is in and who is out? At a minimum, Paul's letter to the Galatians offers us two starting points: unity and holiness. Unity and holiness. Who are the children of God? Those who pursue unity and oneness with the rest of God's children. Who are the children of God? Those who pursue the holiness of God, or the kind of character necessary to live well with the rest of God's children. Unity by itself doesn't need Jesus, and holiness by itself doesn't need others. And without Jesus and others, you never actually have anything like unity or holiness. Unity and holiness together is what Paul is calling the church to. The unity found in Christ's death on the cross for all of us, where all of us are on a level playing field, and holiness defined by Christ's willingness to give up himself for me while I was still his enemy. What are you looking for in the church? What would happen if today we set our lives in the Spirit toward unity and holiness? Unity brought by Jesus and holiness defined by Christ-likeness. What a call. Grace and peace, friends. Amen.